Sounds True presents Tape 3 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield.
Who are you really, wanderer? Satori and the Gate of Oneness. One day I wiped out all notions from my mind. I gave up all desire. I discarded all the words with which I thought, and stayed in quietude. I felt a little queer, as if I were being carried into something, or as if I were touching some power unknown to me, and I entered. I lost the boundary of my physical body. I had my skin, of course, but I felt I was standing in the center of the cosmos. I spoke, but my words had lost their meaning. I saw people coming toward me, but all were the same man. All were myself. I had never known this world. I had believed that I was created, but now I must change my opinion. I was never created. I was the cosmos, and no individual existed. Zen Master S. It is the goal of spiritual life to open to the reality that exists beyond our small sense of self. Just as we can enter this reality through our shared suffering, or through vast emptiness, we can enter through the gate of oneness and discover what can be called awakening as the beloved. Through the gate of oneness, we awaken to the ocean within us. We come to know in yet another way that the seas we swim in are not separate from all that lives. This gate shows us the mystery of divine connection. Every culture has rituals and voices that call us to this truth. It is there when we hear the performance of a mass by Handel or Mozart, and when we enter an ancient cathedral with the sun shining through the stained glass. It is there dancing in ashrams in India, and with the dervishes in Turkey, chanting the names of the divine through the long night. It is there in the Native American sun dance, and when the sacred spirit is present, we can only bow in gratitude. As one American Swami describes it, "Blissful energy exploded up within me to the top of my head, and my heart was full of love for everything and everyone, and I kept bowing and touching the ground and saying blissfully, 'The earth is my witness, the earth is my witness,' over and over." The deepest forms of meditation, ritual, prayers, and sacred art act to reopen our eyes and hearts to this oneness. In Returning to the Source, Wilson Van Dusen explains what it is like to be a mystic in the West, as one who has experienced the divine countless times, in a summer sunset, in the eyes of a child, in the taste of an apple. What is it like to be a mystic in this world? In part, it is sad. Mystics can go through a long period in which they have experiences of God, but they remain unsure. Once, after a talk in a church, an old woman waited until the crowd of people cleared. She came up to me afterward. I saw that she was not very long for this world. Acting circumspectly, she recited a short dream in which an amazing golden sun came to her and asked me if it was God. I first thought of my standard reply, "Well, we need to go into the dream and see what's in it." But then I was struck by the emotional impact of the larger situation. This old woman is dying, and it matters very much to her if she met God even once in this life. And I said, "Yes, it was God," and we both broke into tears. But how sad! She had the marks of a very spiritual person whose life was embedded in God, and yet she asks desperately if once she had met him. To me, she represents most of mankind. She is already well on her way, but she does not recognize the signs. Every tradition has its mystics, and every sincere form of practice can bring the revelation of oneness. One rabbi describes this knowledge and how it came to him on a summer retreat. The experience that opened my whole inner world happened in the midst of a week of prayer and retreat. It was a quiet morning, and I sat down to pray. First, I wrapped myself in a prayer shawl and placed the traditional prayer boxes on my forehead and my arms. "Thou shalt bind them as a sign upon thine arms," it is written. My eyes were closed, and as I quietly prayed, a huge, transcendent light began to glow around me as if it were shining throughout the world. And as it shined to me, it passed through the prayer scrolls, the prayer boxes, imprinting itself directly into my body. This luminosity shone through all three prayer boxes, and in every direction it imprinted the great prayer into my cells, the essence of my being. This great prayer is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one," which means that in all things there is only God. In that moment, I understood why the mystical tradition is so concerned that written prayers be perfect, that none of the letters be broken or damaged. Instead of saying the prayer, I was dwelling in it. It was the marvelous experience of being a prayer realized. I know that our very lives, our very bodies, are a prayer. I know it now. And from that point on, I would read the Psalms and prayers from David to the Talmud, and it would all open up. The great sages of the past were clearly speaking from a transformed state of consciousness. A story about a Taoist hermit in the mountains conveys the truth of our oneness with divine humor. A formal delegation from the Confucian temple below decided to visit and seek his advice. When they arrived at his hut unannounced, they were scandalized to find him completely naked. "What are you doing meditating in your hut with no pants on?" they demanded. "Oh, the whole world is my hut," he replied. "This small room is my pants. What I want to know is, what are you doing in my pants?" This is the truth we already know intuitively. A character in one of Alice Walker's novels describes it this way. "One day, when I was sitting quiet and feeling like a motherless child, which I was, it came to me. That feeling of being part of everything, not separate at all. And I knew that if I cut a tree, my arm would bleed. And I cried and laughed and run all around the house. I just knew what it was. In fact, when it happens, you can't miss it." The world is our hut. We know that the air we breathe is shared with the oaks and fir trees of the forest, that the water we drink pours down from floating clouds as rain before it comes into our cells. All that we possess and are is a gift given us by the wholeness from which we come and to which we return. Our minds and bodies are not separate. The glimpse of oneness awakens a natural compassion and sense of justice out of which we come to treat the other parts of ourselves, all that is, wisely. Awakening to oneness, we discover that we have the same last name as the mountains, the streams, and the redwood trees. A full experience of this truth is called Satori, the first taste of enlightenment. All of us are candidates for Satori, for remembering our true name. We need only learn to let go. For one European Zen master, the first experience of Satori came at age 37. As a student, he had come to spiritual life in part to escape the pain and confusion of his family, and in part to move into a bigger reality that he knew was possible. The discipline he undertook was not confined to the traditional practices of Zen. It included dream work, healing, and therapy, each helping him untangle and release his past sorrows and defenses. All along, he continued sitting Zazen as well. My first experience of Satori came in the midst of Zen training, but only after 9 years of both psychological healing and intensive meditation practice. Then, somehow, it was as if enough preparation and purifying had taken place. I was ripe. One night I dreamt of a sacred mountain with the shrines of ancient saints at the bottom. I knew it was visible to only a few. In the dream, I was climbing the mountain while licking a big ice cream cone, and all the children of the world were streaming down from the top of the mountain. The children were joyfully racing down into the world, but I had the ice cream cone and I was giggling. For all of us, there was only laughter, innocence, so different from my actual childhood. It was as if some new possibility opened inside me. I went into spring retreat shortly after this dream. I remember experiencing a deep, pure meditation and thinking I was beginning to find what I had quested for. But I knew enough to just let it go and meditate some more. And then on the fourth day, my mind fell into chaos, and I thought, well, I was wrong. But instead of using concentration as a sword to cut the confusion away, casting all out except the luminous ground, I embraced the chaos with all my heart. Then body, mind, and the world started to open. It was like a great wave opening over me. I was filled with joy and clarity. It was both empty and full, cool winter and warm spring together. I felt I could understand everything. This went on for days, for weeks. I remember at the retreat, sitting in the middle of the afternoon when everybody is tired and stiff and struggling, and I was so happy. We would go to see the Zen master, who would ask his impossible questions, and I smiled to myself, oh, I know the answer to this, but I just kept sitting. The energy built and built. Finally, I went into the master, and he asked one of the oldest koans, punctuated with a small hand gesture. With this gesture, the whole room fell away. Everything was gone. The wind, the stars, the dogs outside. We all disappeared into the same vastness. There was nothing and everything, and I laughed and laughed in astonishment. I knew the mind of my teacher. I knew the age of the world. My body became transparent. The blowing of the wind was my breath. My steps were the earth moving herself. After this, life was so joyful, alive, my oldest fears were washed away, just gone. I was finally truly alive. And even though I was smiling for weeks and months, it was an odd thing. I didn't tell anyone in the community what was happening because I knew somehow that people would feel left out. In that way, I immediately became aware of all the painful limitations in this world. How even within the great openness, the limitations must absolutely be respected. In awakening, our whole sense of identity shifts. We let go of our small sense of self and enter the unbounded consciousness out of which we come. What becomes known with absolute certainty is that we are not and never have been separate from the world. It is as if our heart, our knowing, expands further and further until we contain everything, until we are the world. For a second you see, and seeing the secret, you are the secret. The Sufis call it becoming one with the beloved. What we have sought to know illuminates our own body and heart, as in the experience of a Dominican nun who has been in her order for 42 years. Even from childhood, I had a very personal relationship with Jesus. As a nun, I had made up this question, especially as I learned more about prayer. Where is Jesus now? We would pray and serve and try to make our hearts pure to receive him. But I knew it was more than that. Jesus would come to me at night as a strong, comforting spirit. He even entered my body. On many occasions, A spiritual ecstasy rushed like a lover for hours through every part of my body. I was up for hours. I couldn't really talk about it, even though I felt radiant and profoundly fulfilled. He flooded my heart with such love, I began to see him, Jesus, everywhere, in people who were struggling, in the poor, in the least of his creatures, in my sisters, in the rich, too. I served them all with love as Christ in his distressing disguise. To some it might sound like heresy, but Jesus is here among us, in every human, in every stone, in our deeds, in our successes, and in our errors. His glory is in the apricot tree in the garden, the gift I give to my niece, in my own hands and eyes. I feel him moving in this very body I've been given. What a beautiful kingdom to awaken to, the divine presence in the world. When our identity expands to include everything, we find a peace with the dance of the world. The ocean of life rises and falls within us, birth and death, joy and pain. It is all ours, and our heart is full and empty, large enough to embrace and be one with it all. The gateless gate, the gate of the eternal present. Actually, there's no real teaching at all for you to chew on or squat over. But not believing in yourself, you pick up your baggage and go around to other people's houses, looking for Zen, looking for Tao, looking for mysteries, looking for awakenings, looking for Buddhas, looking for masters, for teachers. You think this is searching for the ultimate, and you make this into your religion. But this is like running blindly. The more you run, the farther away you are. You just tire yourselves, and to what benefit in the end? Zen Master Fōyan. And the Advaita teachings put it this way. A young man asked the master, "However can I get emancipated?" The master replied, "Who has ever put you in bondage?" Sometimes we meet very wise people who have never gone anywhere special, never undertaken a systematic spiritual practice, never had a mystical experience. They can appear as the generous-hearted and loving childcare worker, the sage who works in the local bookstore, or the compassionate grandmother beloved by an entire community. Such people emanate wisdom, immediacy, a gracious and free heart. They exemplify those who are unafraid to live, to love, and to let go. When we speak about undertaking a spiritual path, such people raise a question for us. What about those who practice for many years, growing into an ever-deepening wisdom, but never have any particular, remarkable experience of grace, satori, or awakening? This, too, is quite common. How does it happen? Examining these examples helps us to undo a possible confusion set up by the last chapters. Just as there is danger for a culture that ignores the process of initiation and the true experience of satori, or of grace and illumination, there is also a danger in describing them in too much detail. The danger is that they will become too important in our minds, or that we will glamorize these stories and come to believe they're necessary in order to live a spiritual life. But if we hold some special experience as our goal, we may spend years seeking that goal outside of ourselves, grasping after something that is here within us all along. Or we may begin to doubt ourselves and our own experience and judge our heart and spiritual life as inadequate and insufficient in comparison. When I returned to my teacher Ajahn Chah after completing a long period of intensive training in other monasteries, I told him about all the insights and special experiences I'd encountered. He listened kindly and finally responded, "It's just something else to let go of, isn't it?" We need to remember that where we are going is here, that any practice is simply a means to open our heart to what is in front of us. Where we already are is the path and the goal. When asked about the path of practice, Buddha explained that there are four ways for spiritual life to unfold. The first way is quickly and with pleasure. In this, opening and letting go come naturally, like an easy birth, accompanied with joy and rapture. The second way is quickly but painfully. On this path, we might face a powerful near-death experience, an accident, or the unbearable loss of someone we hold beloved. This path passes through a flaming gate to teach us about letting go. The third form of spiritual progress is gradual and accompanied with pleasure. In this way, opening and letting go happen over a period of years, predominantly with ease and delight. The fourth and most common path is also slow and gradual, but takes place predominantly through suffering. Difficulty and struggle are a recurrent theme, and through them, we gradually learn to awaken. In this matter, we do not get to choose. Our unfolding is a reflection of the pattern of our lives, which are sometimes described as our fate or karma. No matter the apparent speed, we are simply asked to give ourselves to this natural process. In fact, we cannot measure our progress. It is like being on a small rowboat on the ocean. We row, but there's also a larger current. We may continually head east, but we cannot know how far we have gone. The question of distance and time, however, is only one that arises at the beginning. It doesn't matter how far we think we have gone. It is simply our willingness to open, radically and repeatedly, just now, that characterizes this journey. Perhaps to be accurate, we could add a fifth way to the four paths of spiritual unfolding described by the Buddha. And that is the way that involves no effort, no speed, and no journey. Instead of passing through the gate of oneness or the gate of sorrow, we pass through the gateless gate, the realization that the whole idea of journey and striving is an illusion, because where we are going is just here. To understand this better, we need to acknowledge two complementary ways in which awakening and illumination are discovered. One is through the path of striving and effort, the other through the path of non-effort. In the path of effort, you purify yourself, you struggle to release all the obstacles to being present, you focus yourself on awakening or illumination so fully that everything else falls away. Finally, you are forced to release the one last grasping, the desire for enlightenment itself. And in this letting go, everything becomes clear. In the path of non-effort, there is no struggle. You open yourself to the reality of the present. To rest in the sense of naturalness is all that is asked, and yet out of this, all understanding and compassion will follow. In fact, both ways are at times part of everyone's journey. Both ways lead to letting go. As one of my teachers, Deepa Ma, would say, both ways are best. Wise effort is important, yet no matter how arduous the path, and how much effort is expended, in the end, the awakening of the heart comes as an act of grace, like a spring wind that wafts away all our concerns and fears, that refreshes the heart. To meditate and pray and listen is like throwing the doors and windows open. You can't plan for the breeze. As Suzuki Roshi puts it, you can't make a date with enlightenment. And a similar saying goes, gaining enlightenment is an accident. Spiritual practice simply makes us accident prone. When we grasp, we miss the moment that is here just now. There's the story of an eager Zen student who arrives at the temple. He said, I want to join the community and work to attain enlightenment. How long will it take me? 10 years, replied the master. Well, how about if I really work and double my efforts?
20 years.
Hey, just a moment, that's not fair. Why did you double it? In your case, said the master, I'm afraid it will be 30 years. For one Sufi master, the experience of opening has taken the form of an ongoing process rather than appearing as a single great event of transformation. While I, of course, remember various insights and revelations, on the whole, my spiritual life has been a process of years and years of consciousness opening. This process simply has to be respected and encouraged. If I pay attention to what is happening inside me, what wants to open next, it will always intensify. And as I sense each new capacity, I also discover what is in the way, preventing my opening. So if I sense my compassion is growing, I also encounter the doubts and resistances that stop me from being really compassionate. Acknowledging this becomes the next step in the process of opening. Even though we know the truth, we have to work through the holding and belief that keep us limited. For a long time, you have to keep this opening process going by paying attention, but you reach a point where it goes on by itself. There's no turning back, because you know what it is to rest in true being, to trust, even though you fall back into resistance sometimes. Because you know that this is who you are, your understanding can't disappear. Rather than seeking enlightenment as a state far away, we learn to recognize that it is, as Zen teaches us, nearer than near. The Gateless Gate honors this natural awakening as our birthright. Ajahn Chah, living amid a Buddhist culture that overemphasized the long, arduous journey to enlightenment, took great care to remind his monks and nuns that their own awakening was natural and just at hand. He used to say that if you hadn't tasted the stream of enlightenment in the first 6 months at the monastery, you'd been wasting your time. He pointed out that enlightenment is our inherent state, and that we can learn to rest in our naturally silent and free heart, independent of all the changing conditions around us. Within itself, he said, the mind is timeless, naturally peaceful, unmoving. Rest in this natural state. If the changing sense impressions cause the mind to forget itself, to be deceived and entangled, your practice is to see this whole process and simply return to the original mind. Ajahn Chah reminds us that our careful reflection and earnest meditation can show us this reality whenever we become still. All experiences are without a self, without independent existence. They arise like the wind, according to certain conditions, and pass away. In any quiet moment of seeing this truth, he taught, we can step out of all the conditions that we call self and rest in the timeless knowing, the awareness, the unconditioned. Thus, the difficult practice we undertake is to know the changing world and not get lost in it. In this teaching, the figure and ground of our experience are reversed. Illumination is our true state, and spiritual practice is a way to release our entanglements and live in the reality of the present. Who we are is the goal. A Buddhist meditation master tells how her life had been transformed. But for her, too, there's no event, no powerful satori that she can point to. Instead, it is the endless stream of awakening itself. Here I am, a teacher for hundreds and hundreds of students, some of whom have experienced powerful meditative openings. But that has not been my way. For a long time, this was the hardest thing for me to accept, that nothing happened. I'm simply not a person with big, dramatic experiences. For 30 years now, it's been a process of practicing without being caught by my own ideas of discouragement or success. I would go for months of intensive training, and no spectacular experience would happen. This was especially hard for the first 10 years, but at least I never got trapped into believing I was a special spiritual person. Yet somehow, something did change. What most transformed me were the endless hours of mindfulness, giving a caring attention to what I was doing. I learned that the inner dropping of burdens was not going to happen for me all in one piece, but again and again. I simply dropped the burden of my judgment, of my fear, of distrust of myself, of tightness of body and mind. At some point, I discovered how automatically tightness and grasping would come, and with that realization, I started letting go, opening to an appreciation of life, finding an ease. The traditional teachings slowly dawned on me that in reality, there is neither coming nor going, and that from the ground of being, nothing ever really happens or will ever happen. Seeing this was like a confirmation of what I already knew. I became less serious, less concerned about myself, less ambitious. My kindness started to deepen. Oddly enough, some of my friends tell me I've become more and more like myself. They say there's been a very big change in me, but it wasn't produced by any special event. I guess it is just the fruit of being present over and over. It's that simple. It's easy for us to get caught in the notion that there's a goal, a state, a special place to reach in spiritual life. Accounts of extraordinary experiences can create ideas of how our lives should be and lead us to compare ourselves with others. In Tibet, one famous yogi had lived for years practicing ardently in a mountain hut supported by the villagers below. Then, one festival day, he heard that all his supporters were going to visit him. The yogi carefully swept his hut, polished the offering bowls on the altar, made a special offering, and cleaned his robes. Then he sat back and waited, but an unease came over him. Who was he trying to be? Finally, he got up, scooped up several handfuls of dirt, and threw them back onto the altar. Those handfuls of dirt were said to be his highest spiritual offering. When we enter the gateless gate, we come to the end of seeking. Before this in our life, we may have tried many ways to find enlightenment or to become something special. Finally, we enter the gate of the eternal present and discover that we're not going anywhere. Where we are is the place, the only place, for the perfection of patience, peace, freedom, and compassion. The Zen tradition is full of such accounts. A disciple of Zen master Kassan first lived with the master, but finding the teachings there not to suit him, he left to go on pilgrimage. But everywhere he went, he heard praise for his own master Kassan as the best of the teachers. At last he returned. Greeting his old master, he demanded, "Why did you not reveal your profound understanding to me?" The master replied with a gentle smile, "When you boiled rice, did I not light the fire? When you handed out food, did I not hold out my bowl to receive it? When did I ever betray you?" And at this, the monk was enlightened. The holy perfection we seek has been here all along. Dame Julian of Norwich described this perfection at the center of her prayers when she wrote, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. To recognize the perfection of things as they are is a radical opening of the heart, an awe of the sacred wholeness that underlies all things even now. It is always here, and we can awaken to it in any situation. Then the question may arise, why hasn't some taste of enlightenment or perfection revealed itself to me? The truth is, it probably has, but we have not noticed it or recognized it. It is like the invisible air that surrounds us, that sustains our life. Ajahn Buddhadasa, whose monastery spread across a great forest of the Malay Peninsula, invited his students to sit with him in the coolness of the trees. Then he made a point of directing his students to look for nirvana in the simplest ways, in everyday moments. Nirvana, he would say, is the coolness of letting go, the inherent delight of experience when there is no grasping or resistance to life. He went on, anyone can see that if grasping and aversion were with us all day and night without ceasing, who could ever stand them? Under that condition, living beings would either die or become insane. Instead, we survive because there are natural periods of coolness, of wholeness, of letting go and ease. In fact, they last longer than the fires of our grasping and fear. It is this that sustains us. We have periods of rest, making us refreshed, alive, and well. Why don't we feel thankful for this everyday nirvana? We already know how to let go. We do it every night when we go to sleep. And that letting go, like a good night's sleep, is delicious. Opening in this way, we can live in the reality of our wholeness. A little letting go brings a little peace. A greater letting go brings us a greater peace. Entering the gateless gate, we begin to treasure the moments of wholeness. We begin to trust the natural rhythm of the world, just as we trust our own sleep and how our own breath breathes itself. On a retreat, a healer and psychologist who had devoted 15 years to spiritual practice was struggling yet again with the question of relationship. Feelings of longing and craving and blame kept coming up again and again. We talked, and I suggested he spend some days directing a loving-kindness meditation toward himself. At first he resisted. Like so many of us, he felt uncomfortable focusing on himself. It was awkward to offer the intention of love and kindness to himself over and over for days. But as the retreat went on, his heart softened. Forgiveness for himself and others arose. The world began to look more beautiful, and then came a realization. It is I who must love myself. No one else can make me feel whole. Only I can provide that love. And now I know that wholeness is always accessible to me and to all beings everywhere. This knowing allows me to live with a new peacefulness and a kindness to myself and others. In the simplest way, it has changed my whole life. Again, the lesson of spiritual practice is not about gaining knowledge, but about how we love. Are we able to love what is given to us, to love in the midst of all things, to love ourselves and others? Are we able to see the illumination offered by the sun every morning? If we cannot, we must do in the body, heart, and mind whatever it takes to allow us to open ourselves, to let go, to rest in our natural perfection. The gate is open. What we seek is just here in front of us. It is so today and every day. Meditation teacher Larry Rosenberg went to practice with Zen Master Sungsan in Korea. During the journey, he undertook a pilgrimage to other masters and temples, and while traveling on a remote road, he came across a particularly elegant Buddhist shrine or stupa at the base of a mountain. Next to it was a sign, "Way to the most beautiful Buddha in all of Korea," and an arrow pointing to the 1,000-step path up the mountain. Larry decided to climb, hiking up the steps until he reached the top. The view was breathtaking in every direction. The simple Zen stone pagoda matched the elegance of the one below. But in place of the Buddha on the altar, there was nothing, only empty space and the gorgeous green-hilled vista beyond. When he went closer, at the empty altar was a plaque that read, "If you can't see the Buddha here, you had better go down and practice some more." Part 3. No Enlightened Retirement. From Julian of Norwich. If there be anywhere on earth a lover of God who is always kept safe, I know nothing of it, for it was not shown to me. But this was shown, that in falling and rising again, we are always kept in that same precious love. And from René Daumal, you cannot stay on the summit forever. You have to come down again. One climbs and one sees. One descends and one sees no longer, but one has seen. There is an art of conducting oneself by the memory of what one saw higher up. When one no longer sees, one can at least still know. On the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, after vowing to awaken, he was attacked by the armies of Mara, the god of illusion and evils. Seated under the Bodhi tree, he was able to meditate unmoved by Mara's strongest temptations of greed and pleasure. And then, with a heart of compassion, he overcame the anger and aggression unleashed by Mara, and Mara left defeated. After this, the Enlightened One rose to teach throughout India for 45 years. In the stories of the Buddha's later life, however, we learn that Mara's disappearance was only temporary. Many times afterward, Mara returned to fight or tempt or undermine the Buddha. It is said the Buddha recognized Mara each time he appeared, and so was not caught by temptation, fear, or doubt. "Is that you again, Mara?" the Buddha would ask, and being recognized, Mara would slip away, only to try again another time. In other texts, the Buddha and Mara actually become friendly. In one version, the Blessed One is seated in a cave when Mara reappears. The disciples outside become frightened and try to get rid of Mara, calling him an enemy of their teacher. "Did the Buddha say he had enemies?" counters Mara. Seeing the untruth of these words, they reluctantly summon the Buddha, who responds immediately with interest. "Oh, my old friend has come," said the Buddha, as he warmly greets Mara, inviting him in for tea. "How have you been?" As they sit together, Mara complains about how difficult it is to be an evil one all the time. The Buddha listens to Mara's stories sympathetically and then asks, "Do you think it's easy to be a Buddha? Do you know what they do to my teachings and what they do in the name of the Buddha at some of my temples? There are difficulties being in either role, a Buddha or a Mara. No one is exempt." In one scripture, the story ends when Mara becomes awakened as a Buddha himself. Inevitable transitions. No matter what version we read, Mara does not go away. There is no state of enlightened retirement, no experience of awakening that places us outside the truth of change. Everything breathes and turns in its cycles. The moon, the stock market, our hearts, the wheeling galaxies all expand and contract with the rhythm of life. All spiritual life exists in an alternation of gain and loss, pleasure and pain. For each of us, even the Buddha, it is only by letting go into this truth that we awaken to that which is timeless, the reality of freedom. For almost everyone who practices, cycles of awakening and openness are followed by periods of fear and contraction, times of profound peace and newfound love are often overtaken by periods of loss, by closing up, fear, or the discovery of betrayal, only to be followed again by equanimity or joy. In mysterious ways, the heart reveals itself to be like a flower that opens and closes. This is our nature. The only surprising thing is how unexpected this truth can be. It is as if deep down, we all hope that some experience, some great realization, enough years of dedicated practice might finally lift us beyond the touch of life, beyond the mundane struggles of the world. We cling to some hope that in spiritual life we can rise above the wounds of our human pain, never to have to suffer them again. We expect some experience to last. But permanence is not true freedom, not the sure heart's release. Every wise voyager learns that we cannot hold on to the last port of call, no matter how beautiful. To do so would be like holding our breath, creating a prison from our past. As one Zen master puts it, enlightenment is only the beginning, is only a step of the journey. You can't cling to that as a new identity, or you're in immediate trouble. You have to get back down into the messy business of life, to engage with life for years afterward. Only then can you integrate what you have learned. Only then can you learn perfect trust.